Welcome to the Soft Focus podcast. I'm so happy you're here. My name is Corinne McAndrews, and I am a farmer and the founder of Late Bloomer Ranch. Several years ago, I started to notice that my farm thrived when I took a step back and started to embrace a more holistic worldview. I began to realize my farm was more than just transactions or dollar signs. It was a seemingly magical place with so much happening that I couldn't fully understand it. This led me to embrace complexity and begin to see the beauty in things even when they seem difficult. I started to understand the power of the idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and that by acting from a heart-centered place, we can accept the complexity of things and act in the best interest of the larger puzzle. I want to explore that and talk with other people across disciplines who are viewing the world that way and are looking for those very same connections, because that, I feel, provides peace, humility, and compassion, things that the world could use a lot more of today. I need to be constantly reminded of my important but small role in this bigger cycle. Thank you for being here and for joining me. Hi, welcome back to the podcast. I'm really excited about today's episode. I had the pleasure of connecting with Brittany Chambers. She is an infant and family sleep specialist. She goes by Goodnight Moonchild on Instagram and goodnightmoonchild.com. And she is just a wealth of information. I started this podcast because I wanted to have interesting conversations that helped me make sense of things that seemed paradoxical or that weren't making sense to me on the surface. And certainly the rigmarole in our culture around infant sleep fit that description. When I first got pregnant with my older daughter, I didn't really think about all the particularities of exactly how we would raise her. That came in time after she was here and we started to adjust. But I knew from the beginning that we would co-sleep because the place we were living at the time didn't have room for a crib. And it just felt more natural anyway. So connecting with Brittany was near the top of my list because I just wanted to think about what about infant sleep in our culture is so difficult? Why is it so upsetting for people to talk about? How come many of these topics seem like parents criticizing other parents? Where's the support? Where's the humanity? Brittany talks a lot about biology and how so much of our modern sleep culture is not paying attention to our mammalian biology and the way that our bodies grow and our brains develop. I found that to be a fascinating part of the conversation and something that I truly know nothing about. And what she shared in our conversation confirmed a lot of what I intuitively knew, that co-sleeping and bed sharing and nursing on demand, all these things can be incredibly profound for the growth and development of a young baby, and also for the family at large. So that in and of itself was like a light bulb for me in the conversation. Why are we so divorced from our intuitive understanding of how to raise children? Our desire to be around kids, but not want to spoil them, or our desire to pick up the baby when they cry, but not wanting to create a bad habit, or whatever stuff we're told. If you feel as a parent of a young child trapped in that discourse yourself, oh, I'm drawn to parenting one way, but everyone in my life is telling me that it's wrong or that it will create bad habits or it will create a dependency, I encourage you to check out today's conversation and to connect with Brittany yourself, because there's just so much more to it than simply spoiling a child or encouraging protestations or crying or tantrums. That's very black and white thinking. And getting beyond that and getting in touch with really connecting with your baby and yourself, it's such a magical world. So without any further delay, please enjoy today's conversation. Let me know what you think. Send it to someone who you think would enjoy it. And if you are enjoying the podcast, please do leave us a review and a rating. I love getting your emails. I love getting your Instagram messages. It means the world to me. So enjoy Brittany. Hi, Britt. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Corinne. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to talk to you. As I mentioned before we met for this podcast, I absolutely love co-sleeping, and I can't wait to dig into why that is and what about co-sleeping is so magical. But before we get into the data of it all, can you tell me why you became so passionate about this subject?
Yes, happy to. And I love to hear that you love co-sleeping. This is the rhetoric we need. So I became so passionate about this subject, I think if I can reach back a little bit into my unconscious memories, and some of which are conscious actually, but I was a kid who was sleep trained, and I was sleep trained by parents who were not informed or aware of any other way of dealing with infant sleep. It was really tumultuous, my relationship to sleep, my parents' relationship to sleep. It could be argued that they didn't have another kid for 9 years because of sleep, because I was the same person I am today, but packed into a little body, and I was super sensitive and required a lot of parental proximity. And I was a kid that sleep training didn't work for. So the crying never ceased. And every night I would cry myself to sleep, basically, which caused my parents a ton of distress. So growing up, there was this almost like joke that I never thought was funny, but didn't look into too deeply around like, oh, Britt, you gave us such a hard time with sleep. Like sleep was so difficult. And my parents had a very closed door policy. Even when I was old enough to understand what was happening, I wasn't allowed in their room. I wasn't allowed in their bed. If that exception was made, it was because I was sick or because I really, really had a specific need or because one of the two parents were away on a trip or something. So sleep was fraught in my household. And when I became pregnant with my daughter in 2020, I didn't think anything of sleep because truly, Corinne, I just thought baby slept. Like despite this background, I just internalized the dialogue around my own sleep and was like, oh, I am a really sensitive creature. I just must have had a hard time with it. So I didn't think that that was indicative of some biological truth that my parents weren't attuned to. So I end up pregnant, not thinking about sleep. I have my daughter and I tried to have an out-of-hospital birth that ended up in the hospital. And it was really beautiful and unmedicated. And so I was lucid and they attempted to, of course, separate us. And there was a lot of language around, it's not safe for her to sleep with you. She needs to sleep next to you in this little plastic bassinet thing. And I just was like, no, she's going to stay right here on my body, like in the crook of my arm and nursing. And we can figure this out. She can be on my chest. It was so intuitive to me. Then we left the hospital. We got home. And the first night, I had this little sidecar bassinet next to me already. And my husband and I looked at each other and we were like, okay, no, we can't put her in there. Like it was right there, right next to me. But I was still feeling such a pull to be heart to heart and chest to chest with her. So I put her on my body and began Googling, right? As so many mothers do. And I was like, is this normal? Is this okay? It felt okay in my bones, which is why I moved forward. It felt like the most obvious, intuitive way of being with her. So this Google search led me down a very long path of exploring our biological norms as humans and exploring who the human infant is. And when I uncovered that we have a massive societal misunderstanding of who babies are and how to respond to them at night and how to be in relation to our babies day and night, really, but particularly at night, it was a whole body resonance. This is what I need to do. This is the work that I need to do in the world. And I need to help parents realize that nothing is wrong with their baby. Nothing is wrong with their drive to be close to their baby. And their baby is not broken for needing them at night. So I ended up studying with Dr. Greer Kirschenbaum and just fell in love with the literature and the academia. And I got very curious about anthropology and developmental psychology and neuroscience. And it's just been a love affair with that topic ever since. I just love learning and exploring who we really are and what we need and how far we've come from remembering our nature.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that story. I resonate so deeply with every minute of it. Part of my family myth was that I was the difficult child. And both of my parents had professional careers outside of the home. And that was very important to both of them, which I can completely validate. But the constant crying, the constant colic was a huge impediment to, air quotes, getting back to work. Or in the 80s and 90s, careers for women who were mothers, it wasn't easy. I'm not pretending like I had to live through that competitive environment.
But what came out of it was like a deep resentment towards the child who had trouble sleeping, who had trouble quieting, who was always colicky. I remember my mom telling me that they would like put my baby seat on top of the dryer in the basement and let it run so it would agitate the seat because they felt like helpless.
Yeah.
And she was visiting recently and said, you know what? I think if I had had different tools, I would have done it differently. And it broke my heart a little bit for all the people out there who have probably had that same thought. Because I raise animals for a living, mostly mammals, some poultry. There's nothing you can do to get them to not sleep in a pile. It's literally every ounce of their being wants to be together at night. It's the cutest, most heartwarming thing. And then we think that we're different.
Yeah, and we are not. We're the only mammal that doesn't co-sleep. I paused there before I said the word co-sleep because we actually have co-slept always until the last 150 years. So that's where that came from. It came from the rise of industrialization. So here's the thing. Before the Industrial Revolution, there wasn't a reason to manipulate or control sleep because we could rise and fall with the cycles of the sun and the earth and the cues that nature was giving us. The mammalian circadian clock is part of what drives sleep. And we listened to our bodies and understood the cues that our bodies were giving us. We didn't need schedules. We didn't need tracking apps. We didn't need to control the environment because there wasn't a necessity. And there's some arguments that sleep was biphasic, that we slept in chunks and that there were periods of wakefulness in the middle of the night that was totally normal and people would do chores or they would read by candlelight or they would whatever. And so we've gotten to this place where we think sleep is one thing. We think it's one flavor and that it needs to be, for infants, the gold standard. I'm using air quotes, is like 7 to 7. And adults need like their 8 hours at night. And that's contentious if you look at anthropology, if you look at the field of anthropology. So what occurred with the turn of the 19th century? I think I'm referencing that right, as in the end of the 1800s. So at the end of the 1800s. The last bit as the Industrial Revolution was rising and light bulbs were invented and people had to go to work outside of the home in factories increasingly, right? They needed to wake up at a certain time. The top down was let's control, let's optimize sleep so that people can feel rested and there are not accidents in factories. And of course, if people have to leave the home to work in this era, then they also cannot be waking through the night to take care of their baby. It started this whole concept of separation. And then layered on top of that was also germ theory. And at the beginning of the 1900s, there was this recommendation to separate from your infant because infants were at risk of pathogens and needed to be in a sterile, separate environment so that they weren't falling sick and potentially dying. So there was just a gross misunderstanding of biology, of our inherent way of being. And then because this way of being is so incongruent with our biology, it created a bit of chaos because how difficult is it for the average infant to get them to sleep separate, like you described with the animals that you care for, right? It's this super, super survival brain, survival drive to be close to their mother, to be close to their kin. And so recommendations started coming out on ways to accomplish that end, the end of sleeping separate, right? And so this guy, Emmett Holt, wrote this recommendation that is essentially still the baseline for modern sleep training, which was like, go in to the room, lay them down in their crib, and don't come back until morning. And whatever happens in those hours is not for you to concern yourself with, which is wild. That's where this originated, and we are still taking instruction from this incredibly outdated, unscientific basis for this cultural norm of dealing with babies.
I had heard, and I don't know if this is true, that he actually was like a childless individual who wrote a book and it did really well and then just decided to like keep running with it because it took off like wildfire, and it was honestly just sort of a crazy idea that he had, not based at all, even in his own experience. Is that true?
I don't know if he had children or not, but I do know that it is speculated and I'm not sure that it could be proven. I'm not sure. It could be, of course, to see if he has ancestors and children, but I do know that the common rhetoric around him is that he'd never cared for a child, right? He was not on the ground caring for children.
It's amazing. And it's amazing how in 150 years or whatever it's been, it's now seen by some as like almost harmful to sleep with your children. Not only maybe not optimal for parents' sleep, but truly harmful. Is that just a SIDS thing, a sudden infant death syndrome narrative? Or are there other reasons why people tell you that it could be negatively impacting your baby to cuddle with them?
Oh my gosh, I'll give you my real hot take. So the SIDS component, I think, is huge for people. And we can talk about it if you want to. But I actually think what's more at play is that we are so sanitized as a culture. Like, we are so afraid of intimacy. We are so disconnected from the fact that we are mammals, that in some circles, it's uncivilized to sleep with your baby, which is odd, right? I can't find a shred of logic there, because people sleep with other adults. Like, adults co-sleep every night of their lives, arguably. Yeah, I see that too. There's a resistance to the concept of a family bed because of a fear of impeding intimacy, and or on the other but similar side of the coin, this concept of sleeping with your baby is a territory that you don't want to cross because of setting some precedent of being too attached or too connected, which is impossible. You can't be too attached.
I was going to say, my first child, I also got pregnant in early 2020, and she was born in the autumn of that year. And I find her to be so independent and self-assured and confident when she's out in the world. Is there any reason to believe that children who are co-sleeping or having that kind of deep connection with their caregivers when they ask for it, maybe that's not co-sleeping per se, or in like the 100% sense of the term, but children who are able to connect with their parents when they ask and have that level of attentiveness, is there a reason to believe that those children are actually more confident and more self-assured out in the world?
Yes. There are several studies that talk about this potential correlation, but one that I love is that bed-sharing infants are more independent preschoolers with enriched cognition, indicative of a resilient stress system and well-developed thinking brain. And I pulled that quote from the book, The Nurture Revolution, but the citation is actually from a couple of different studies, one in the Journal of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics, one in the Infant Mental Health Journal in 2002, and then again in 2016. And they were looking at relationships between breastfeeding, co-sleeping, and somatic complaints in early childhood. And what they are finding, of course, is that the responsiveness day and night optimizes psychological and physiological development. And then if we look at developmental psych and think about secure attachment, attachment is so multifaceted. I don't want to pretend that it's not. But of course, if you know that any time within the 24-hour cycle of a day on this continuum that you can go to your parent and get your needs met, that of course contributes to a sense of safety and security in the world. So you begin to think that the world is a safe place. So temperament aside, right, there are so many factors here, but one could deductively reason that if a child has that, then they have a nervous system that is primed to go out in the world and assume that they're going to be met with safety and security in the world too.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because I think probably the number one retort that I heard, because of course that's the first thing that they would ask, how is the baby sleeping? Is she a quote, good sleeper? Which I just hate that term. Maybe that's my own childhood.
Same.
Talking, but it's not babies' jobs to be excellent at sleeping. I don't like to give them kind of a letter grade. But people would always ask that. And then the retort I would get would be like, oh, well, I hope they aren't still sleeping in your bed when they're 15, or some sort of cheeky, right? I know it sounds so silly. But of course, the opposite was true, where instead of making her so clingy and helpless and fixated on her mother, it made her really imaginative and independent. I mean, maybe not single-handedly. Like you said, there's other factors, there's temperament. But I think it's really interesting how far some of the misconceptions can go when the lived experience is something entirely different. Do you encounter that a lot in your work?
A lot, yeah. And in my personal life, that's tracked exactly with my daughter. Despite my daughter being an orchid, highly sensitive kid, she is so safe and secure and audacious and independent. She's almost 4, right? So there's like, that's, I would say, a proper use of that term at this point. She does have moments of independence, hours of independence, and I'm still her secure base, but she goes into the world with such safety and joy. She's not expecting this like recoil. She's not expecting to recoil, despite being born with a super sensitive stress system. She's got this foundation of safety. And I see this with my clients too. And one of the things I see that makes me really sad is, without giving away personal stories or personal information, I would say in aggregate, what I see is people that come to me with maybe like their second or their third kid. And they're like, hey, I see a difference because my first time around, I sleep trained. I didn't know any better. I didn't know there was another way. And that kid of mine, who is now 6, 7, 8, whatever, is dealing with really odd nighttime fears. They won't leave my leg at a park. They have some signs that potentially there is like an anxious or an avoidant attachment developing, despite them generally, other than the nighttime and naps, of course, which does make up a huge chunk of a baby's life, they are generally parented the same way. So they come to me with the second and the third kid, and they're like, I want to do things different because I don't like what I'm seeing there. I also have had people come to me that are in the midst of sleep training, 6-month-old, 9-month-old, 12-month-old, and will tell me that they've seen daytime disconnection, like their infant actually disconnecting from the relationship, opting out of serve and return, which is really odd. And I don't know of data that we have on this, of looking at, it would be really interesting. It'd be a really interesting study, actually, like looking at how our infants' daytime interactions with their caregiver affected by nighttime activities. And how does that then extrapolate out to what we're talking about when you've got an older kid? Yeah, I see this all the time. And it's a delicate conversation to have with people, right? Because there are epigenetic factors and genetic factors and temperament overlaid. But I know that from my anecdote and my anecdotal experience, I see that generally speaking, kids that are met with responsiveness day and night have quite a bit of baseline security.
That tracks with my personal experience and some of the people I know who are choosing to have the family bed or leaning into co-sleeping, even some people I know who weren't planning on co-sleeping. Mm-hmm. And it really just breaks my heart because I know how hard mothers are trying. And I think for a lot of people, that sort of hyper-scheduled, hyper-controlled parenting approach is actually a labor of love. It's an attempt to provide the best possible experience for the child. I would imagine that that's what drives some of the contentious nature around this conversation is this feeling of like, I'm doing absolutely everything I can for my kid and I don't want to be criticized. And you mentioned Google with your first child up all night. I think it's really tragic that that's where so many of us find ourselves is looking to Google for some parenting playbook. How do we get out of that mess? Like, where is the light at the end of the tunnel for mothers and fathers, whoever's really doing that primary caregiving, to be able to feel empowered that they can trust their intuition, not have to be up at 4 a.m. with the Reddit thread informing their like strategy around child rearing?
Did you say the control is a labor of love?
Yeah, from my experience, the mothers that I know who parent that way, they are just twisting themselves in knots to make it work. They really want to be creating these optimal environments. Yes, a labor of love for them. And to me, I can look at and see how in my life that would be so counterproductive. I'm not temperamentally set up for that. But yes, that is what I was saying.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I want to quote you because it really hit on something that I do see and that I think requires a tremendous amount of compassion from folks that are having conversations outside of sleep training culture. I think that it is essential to look at the impetus behind the clawing for control. I agree that it's born potentially out of a desire, a really deep desire to do the right thing. And there's a lot of rhetoric about brain development and crap naps and daytime sleep needing to be at a certain level or within a certain threshold to not affect your child's development. That's a lot of what's thrown around in the sleep training community. So I think of people like my mother, they would have heard something like that and been like, okay, I need to do everything in my power to make sure my daughter is raised in an optimal environment. And so I think there's this odd paradox there that we think we're doing the right thing. And how we get out of it. Let's look at the word labor. That alone, we don't need to manipulate our baby's sleep in any way. And I think because where we are in late stage capitalism, where we are in most Western industrialized nations, a lot of us don't know any other way than hyperfixation on individualism and independence and control and thinking about surrendering to rhythm. Where is that even talked about? Zoom out and think about most of us are shuffled into the school system where instantly everything is structured, everything is optimized, everything is measured, everything is tested. We don't know being out in the field and watching the rising and the setting of the sun and watching the birds do their natural thing and watching mammals do their natural thing and understanding that every mammal on the planet knows when to go to sleep. No mammals are sleep trained. They all know. They're like, okay, I'm tired. I'm going to go to sleep now. Barring an underlying medical condition, which does happen and I do encounter for sure, we can trust our babies to know when they're tired. And I also think as babies move out of infancy and move into the preschool years or a little bit older, that is a beautiful example of helping them learn to trust their bodies when we can follow their rhythms and not imposing. And this doesn't mean that we need to throw caution to the wind and never have a rhythm or never have a routine. That's not practical or possible for most people, I would say. But if we did nothing, our babies' brains would take the sleep they needed when they needed, as long as the conditions are conducive to their bodies feeling safe. Because the prerequisites to sleep are that your body can switch into parasympathetic and stay in parasympathetic, and that you have enough sleep pressure, which is dictated, driven by circadian rhythm. So this is why it's a natural process. So we could, for example, hold our babies. We could baby wear. I think one big way we could get out of this paid leave aside and giving mothers and fathers the space to be able to sink into these things, we can strap our babies to our body and go about our life with a baby on our body. And they can sleep like they have for centuries on women that were moving around in the world. I think normalizing contact and closeness and the parental proximity desired by infants and demanded by their biology, we have to normalize that. We have to stop pathologizing infant sleep. I think that's like step one.
I love what you're saying. I think this is my turn for my hot take, and I'm certainly not an expert. So push back on this all you want. I'm just some woman with a lot of opinions and a microphone, but I just feel that we've so overly medicalized and pathologized childbirth, women's health. Wasn't it as recently as the 90s that women were able to take pregnancy tests at home? And I really feel for all the moms out there who just feel like they need someone else's permission to know if their baby is okay or not. Some people may hear me say this and roll their eyes or become upset. I have no idea. I have a 9-week-old. I have no idea how much she naps every day. She naps a lot. Like, I don't track it. I'm not tracking how often she's awake. She's very healthy. She's alert. She's a joy. So I don't think to myself, oh, she's been awake for 45 minutes and she's exactly this weight, exactly this many weeks, her wake window, all that stuff. Just, I literally have no idea.
Yeah.
I know I sleep well. She sleeps well. Everybody's like happy and healthy and eating. And so I'm just going along with my day. How do we get back to a place where we just don't need all this information? It just feels like an overload.
I had an experience at a coffee shop this morning that got me thinking the exact same thing, because I was watching somebody hesitate to go up to the counter, a woman, to ask for what she needed, which was she needed her milk swapped out. She got the wrong milk put in her coffee. And I was watching her shudder in terror, worried about, but this is totally my projection of her worry, but worried about the repercussion of speaking up and maybe somebody being mad. And my brain working the way that it works, I was like, wow, this is a microcosm of what I see every day in the birth and postpartum world that we are living in. Women are so scared of advocating for themselves. They're so scared of speaking up for their needs. This starts prenatally, the fear of denying an exam or denying a whatever it might be, because we have been indoctrinated that we need external validation of our intuition or external validation of XYZ. Like, women don't trust their bodies. Corinne, you know this. So if you don't trust your body, how on earth are you going to trust your baby who came of your body? We're so stuck in logical reasoning and intellectualism that we are our own Achilles heel now. And yeah, I think a lot of women feel like they need permission. I think a lot of women feel like they need to follow the rules. I think that's a byproduct of living in a patriarchy and being raised in good girl culture. And I really want to raise my daughter differently. And I know that performance and pleasing and perfecting is imposed upon our girls from a really young age. And I see the downstream effects of that every single day in my work.
Wow. That's the number one thing I work on, is trying to take better care of myself so that my daughters see that. And not that I am horrible at taking care of myself, but I'm very sensitive to that martyr complex.
Yeah.
It lives in me. It can wreak havoc on my day-to-day, on my relationships, if I let it. And to be able to transcend that and say, I'm actually going to take this 30-minute walk by myself because it's something that I really want to do for myself. And whatever the thing is for the day, it's a real discipline, because it would be so much easier for me personally to fall back into these norms that have existed for so long. The glorified mother who never does anything for herself, and she's always a little bit run ragged just because she loves her family so much. And yes, do I love spending time with my kids? And even when the proverbial shit is really hitting the fan, just connecting with them? Absolutely. I live for that. I live for that. But I can't do that as well if I'm constantly stuck in that overly self-awareness, bordering on self-absorption of how is it going to look if I advocate for myself, or if I'm really real about what I need. It's such a trap.
It's a very toxic trap. And Dr. Sophie Brock, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her work, but she works on breaking down what's called the perfect mother myth. And it's exactly what you just described. And it's just a byproduct of the patriarchy. This doesn't track to our biology. Women weren't like isolated in their huts taking care of their children. That is not what happened. Just at all. Any historian or anthropologist could corroborate that claim. We are the mammals that we are. Like, we have the brains we have because of human infants. This is supported by neuroscience. Like, the way we are wired for empathy and compassion is because we caretook infants together. It's really, really hard to decondition from the culture that we're living in, which does glorify a certain type of way of being as a mother. It does glorify self-sacrifice and uber sacrificial tendencies to the point of, like you said, running yourself ragged. And that doesn't serve anybody other than the status quo.
This episode of The Soft Focus is brought to you by Late Bloomer Ranch, my farm and ranch in eastern Idaho, where we raise meat, eggs, wool, and cut flowers of the utmost quality with integrity to match. You can hear more about the ranch, our practices, and the why behind our premium products in episode 10 of this podcast with ranch manager Eliana Arujo. We now ship flower essences from our flower garden, perfect for altering your auric field and impacting the subtle body, yarn from our registered flock of Lester Long Wool sheep for all your knitting, crocheting, and fiber arts, and our signature bloom boxes chock full of our truly exceptional meat to stock your freezer with the best of the best. We ship all over the continental United States. Supporting Late Bloomer Ranch is supporting the Soft Focus podcast, and we are so glad you're here. Check us out on latebloomerranch.com and on Instagram at Late Bloomer Ranch. Now, back to the episode.
As I'm listening to you talk, the first question that comes to mind is sleep training culture almost an attempt to heal that? I see, again, totally anecdotal, just a crazy woman with a microphone, but what I see is, oh, if I could only get this schedule right, then I would have time to take care of myself. Or then I would actually be able to go have a career, because I do want to do more than just stay inside my own home all day long. Are we just applying like the complete wrong tool for the job?
Yes, I think yes. And looking in the systems that we're functioning in, like in the US where we're having this conversation, we have no paid family leave. Some women go back to work 2 days after they give birth. That is unthinkable. And like literally incomprehensible for me. It's inhumane. It's awful. So when we're parenting inside of those systems, yeah, I think that the anecdote to burnout for some women without layers of support, they go immediately to, okay, there's this intervention that I can do that will theoretically help me. That's questionable logic because A, sleep training doesn't work for a huge chunk of babies, and that's never advertised or talked about and not a part of informed consent, in my opinion. I don't think parents are told that. It's positioned and sold as like this silver bullet. And then secondly, the real problem, the root problem is that we are living in a villageless culture where we don't have women sitting together, caretaking collectively. We don't have the web of support that we used to have. So yeah, I think we are taking this intervention and assuming that it's going to solve the problem when it's actually a Band-Aid.
That's just resonating so deeply. I'd love to hear about how you personally live and work differently. I know for me, right now we're talking, I'm at my farm. My ranch foreman, Ellie, is with my 9-week-old. If something were to go wrong, they could pop in here at any moment. I'm very fortunate that I have this business and this life that allows me to do that. And whenever I hire anyone, that's the first question I ask is, how do you feel about working for a working parent with kids around all the time that you will probably hold a baby or you'll probably have something interrupted by?
What's up?
Yeah. And so is it perfect? Absolutely not. But we get to like at least I come back to work, air quotes, because my work is like a vocation. It's hard for me really to be away from it, but I get to bring my children and do it in a way that is supportive of my family culture. Like, how do you do it?
And integrated. I do it the same way, but oh my gosh, and we could talk forever about this. I won't go on a long tangent about it. But before I had kids, I did not believe in extraction or exploitation of myself, of others. So I was the 25-year-old working in higher education at the time in this very rigid environment where we were expected to be there from 8 to 5. I was the 25-year-old that was like, no, sorry, no. My body is not a machine. I am not going to do that. And if you have any interest in me working here, you got to find another way because I don't function like that. I don't do that. And I think, again, if we look back at good girl culture and all these things, like, takes a lot for women to advocate for themselves. And I do a lot of coaching with women that are going back into the workforce after having a kid. Maybe they took 3 or 4 months off or 6 months off or whatever it might be. And I completely understand the fear. They're saying to me point blank, I am terrified, but I also don't know how to advocate for my needs. I don't know how to say I'm going to be breastfeeding on the Zoom call. So here I am. Or I'm going to be on the Zoom call with my camera off because I'm going to be laying in bed doing a contact nap. And I can type from my phone or I can speak when I get a second. This is terrifying for women because of like job protection purposes, because of the way that we don't have a culture of care. There's no collectivism, it's individualism. So I think people assume to themselves, if I advocate for my needs, I'm just going to be let go. And I find that that's actually not usually the case, that people are more than willing in most environments to accommodate. And I think it's changing. I think it requires everybody advocating to shift culture. And I think it requires embodying and living it in our own lives where and when we can. How this looks for me is that my husband and I share the load. My son is 8 months old in 2 days, and my daughter is almost 4. And my son has done almost every nap of his life on one of our bodies, and we both work full time. And we've done that by rotating and baby wearing and almost having fun with it. We actually argue over who gets to take the baby. We're like, who gets the oxytocin bath? So yeah, like right now I have layers of support. I've got my mother-in-law in the other room with my 8-month-old and my husband with my 4-year-old. And this is like an hour of my day. And then what is behind the scenes, right, is that we hop off our call and I go right back in to mom mode. And I swoop the kids up and we go play and we go exist in the world again until maybe there's another lull where we switch off and do work. There's more than enough hours in the day. So there's nuance there, of course, and complexities, and not everybody has privilege. Not everybody has economic safety and security or financial safety and security. But I do think that most of us, and certainly those of us that are in a position to advocate and to embody a family-centric way of living, I think it's the impetus is on us in order to change it for those who can't.
I almost don't have words because I feel like you said everything that I could have possibly said. I just love how there is, it's almost like I don't want to let the wolf at the door in. This idea that my children are an inappropriate part of whatever I'm doing. Like I'm very rarely willing to entertain that. Heavy machinery, sure. Big rams in the ram pen, okay. But aside from those very few instances, I feel like it's my duty to have my children around with everything that I'm doing. And yes, I have a very supportive spouse, but that wasn't an accident. We did talk about these things. I didn't just magically expect that we would be on the same page about some of these topics. And maybe you have something to say about that too. But I'm also curious, like, about the anthropological angle. I think my parenting experience, maybe I'm very fortunate, maybe I'm just a minority, but my children do really well. I don't want to say not being the focus, but being integrated in our real life. We don't actually do that much, quote, kid stuff, end quote. We do family stuff that we all want to do together. Sometimes it's chores. Sometimes it's down by the river. Sometimes it's riding a horse. Sometimes it's going with mom to a meeting. And it's all one thing.
Completely. There is a book called Hunt Gather Parent that supports this claim. And a mother wrote the book who traveled the world with her toddler daughter to explore other cultures and how they parent. And they do what you said. Cultures that are closer to indigenous wisdom and indigenous ways of living, living with the land and living in and amongst nature and in their interconnectedness, kids are a really important part of those cultures. They play really important roles. They are part of, they're not separate from. And we separate, right? And we're like, kids go here and adults go here. No, integration is where everybody's brains are optimized. And to point to what I was saying earlier a bit about the evolution of the human brain, we're designed to be around infants. All of us, men need to be around babies, grandparents need to be around babies. These are brain changes that our brains are primed for that make us more compassionate and more aware of the fragility and the necessity of life. Again, I could go on forever there about why it is so important to have our kids around and to frame them as full beings that come in part of everything that they're around, and they deserve to have a seat at the table and not be shoved to the side. That's a very Victorian era notion to just separate kids, that children should be seen and not heard. We need to throw that away.
Go get them a governess.
Right.
When you're working with parents and you're bringing them back to some of these ideas, do you have to coach a lot on how to get spouses on board? Or is that something that there's actually less resistance to than people might be afraid of in the first place?
I would say it's pretty mixed. I have women that come to me in confidence and their partners are not on board at all. I used to have a guide, it's under a different name, called So Your Partner Wants to Sleep Train, because that's how often I was dealing with women who were like, I am fully on board. Every cell in my body wants to do this, and but my partner is not, and they will not, and they won't. And everybody at work is telling them that they need to sleep train and get their baby under control and get them on a schedule. So I think there's a bit of a cultural divide there, but I also work with really conscious men that are like, I defer to the wisdom of my partner's body, and whatever she's saying is what we're going to do with the baby, and let me know how to support. So I see a lot of that too. I would say generally it takes a lot of coaxing or reflecting back to men to show them where these beliefs originated. Like, where did you get the idea that babies should be able to sleep alone? And then they're like, where did I get that idea? And then asking them about their relationship to sleep. And I find, if I could draw a correlation, I would say the more like toxic, masculine, patriarchal a guy is, the more resistant they are to co-sleeping and nurturing at night. And that's not to be confused with like a natural masculinity. It's like the subjugation.
Mm-hmm. I find that sometimes the most traditionally masculine men that I know from an internal sense are the most accepting and deferential to that.
Totally agree.
More feminine sensibility. It's interesting.
Yep. It's very interesting.
For the person listening who isn't in the same hyper flexible situation that I'm in, for instance, where I get to have discretion over who works for me and I get to prioritize creating a work environment where children are involved and welcome and essential. Let's say somebody has a more quote unquote traditional job and they feel overwhelmed listening to this, or like, how on earth could I ever raise my children this way? I see the merit in it. I want it, but how can I have this level of attunement and connection Where do you suggest people start?
I would suggest that it starts inside. I think it's an inside job to start. There has to be a willingness to jump into the deep end of discomfort and pick apart some of this conditioning and these beliefs, like a willingness to break cycles often. And there's, like I mentioned earlier, a level of privilege there, because if you are, as I'm thinking of a client that I have, if you are in the service industry and you have to physically go to a job every day from 9 to 5 or whatever it might be, and there is a physical separation from your kids that you can't work around, which is the case for so many people, then what you do when you're with your kids really, really matters, as it does for everybody. But you have an opportunity there to be really attuned to their cues, to be really tuned in to their needs. Learning your baby's cues, I think, is maybe the first thing as an actual action step. Like doing the inside work I could talk about for a very long time, because it's separate and broaches like cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy. And are you able to do breath work and like clear out some of this energy and some of these stuck emotions? Do you do somatic work at all? Do you meditate? Like, how comfortable are you with discomfort? So that's thing one. But then actual action step, if somebody's, this does have merit and I really do want to do this, believe your baby. Believe what your baby is telling you. Pick them up when they cry. Don't believe myths of you can spoil a baby, or don't give a baby attention when they're protesting. Babies aren't protesting. Babies are acting in survival. They have survival brains that they come in with that are driven to connect with you, to seek you out, because you are their co-regulator. You are their safety. You are their survival. So believing your baby, following their cues, keeping them close, keeping them on your body, breastfeeding, co-sleeping, setting up a safe sleep space so that you can nap if you're able to, or sleep at night with your baby nearby. I have a lot of clients actually that work separate during the day and find co-sleeping really healing, because it's this nighttime proximity through something called biobehavioral synchrony. You're literally merging with your baby and you have heart coherence and brain coherence. And it's an opportunity to really sink in and be with. I would say that's a good place to start, learning your baby's cues and believing your baby. And then, of course, serve and return interaction. Sitting in your baby's awe and joy and reveling in their presence will show them that, yeah, you're there. You're loving them for who they are, and that you're so thrilled to be in their presence. And that goes a long way for safety and security and attachment. And then one more thing, hiring caregivers, or opting into caregiving situations that have a nurtured, nested way of thinking and being, having somebody that will sleep with your baby on their body. Mm-hmm. You are employing people, you can dictate that they do that. And I find parents are often a little bit reticent to do that. You can absolutely do that. And then that helps your baby's brain develop in proximity, gives them all of the feel-good neurotransmitters that are a result of contact napping, and is a beautiful way to keep them in that space of regulation.
I wish we had 10 hours to talk about this, but I know you have adorable children that need you and clients.
You've got a wee babe.
Yeah. And as you're talking about that, did you call it serve in return? Or
yeah,
that I'm thinking about, my husband and I last night had this very conversation that her favorite pastime is just staring in your eyes and smiling at you. And to do something that the baby wants to do, it has nothing to do with flashing lights or gizmos, or it's just staring and doing the subtle facial changes of really engaging.
Yeah.
And it's so enjoyable.
It's like when you fall in love with somebody, you want to stare in each other's eyes. You want to merge with them. That's what our babies want too.
Oh my goodness. It's so beautiful. You've referenced it. You work with mothers mostly. How do people get involved with your programs? What are your services exactly?
I do a lot of one-on-one coaching that really meets the mother or the father or the grandparent actually where they are. And we look really deeply first at the mom. And I like to go way back into birth and how birth was, maybe even preconception, to get an idea of mindset, to get an idea of their comfort in their own body. And then we walk through everything that they have encountered until present day. And we look at root cause variables of sleep disturbances. So we go deep into investigation, but then there's this overtone always of what's your intuition? How do we walk you back to your power? So that's a lot of the coaching and integrative infant sleep work that I do. And it's totally possible in a baby-led, biologically normal way to support sleep and help parents solve sleep issues without doing anything that's behaviorist or anything that is disrespectful to the baby's biology. So that's a lot of the work that I do. I'm launching some group coaching, but I also have this group called Cuddle Crew that I love so much because they are a collective of women who co-sleep all over the world. There's 115 of them right now, and they're weaving wisdom together. Like, I am not trying to be the expert in that group that like sits on my armchair and preaches. It's very much women with other women sharing their life experience. And they're all super high nurture parents and they're all co-sleeping, and it's incredibly beautiful. So that's a really good way that has like a low financial barrier. It's $44 a month to go in and be in community with other women. And I have guest speakers, and we do what we call the campfire once a month, where we sit in circle and we're all witnessed and we're all held in whatever we're experiencing, and or we can give each other feedback live. So yeah, that's really special. And those are the predominant ways that I'm working with people right now, since I've got such a little babe.
As I was listening to you share about that, I couldn't resist just asking one more little thing. And do you ever experience, I'm thinking of someone I know personally who loves her new baby, has wanted to be a mom for so long, but really struggles with co-sleeping, contact napping because of like the physicality of it all and not feeling free. Do you ever support people from that point of view? I'm such like a hyper Scorpio. There's no amount of touch that would ever be enough. It's just not a problem I have. But how do you support people on the other side of that who are like, I get the science, I understand it, it's so romantic to me, but like I actually physically need space myself?
Oh, totally. I support people with that all the time. And I think it comes down to nervous system work much of the time. Like, we all have our own sensory thresholds. We all have sensory seeking or avoidant behavior to some degree. Our sensory system sends messages directly to our nervous system, some of which are, hey, run away or hide because this is too much. The input's too much. So a lot of self-regulation techniques from others. Like, so much of my work is that, is advising and supporting women through that so that they can come back to baseline. I mean, I go all directions, Corinne. Like, we talk about somatics, we talk about nutrition, like postnatal depletion cure style. What are you eating? What are you putting in your body? Like, you cannot baby wear if you are feeling terrible because you're coming from this huge nutritional deficit postpartum. So yeah, that could be another episode entirely, but there's so much there. So I help women pull at the tendrils and figure out, okay, what do I really need here to be able to parent the way that I want to parent?
Yeah. And on that note, I would love to talk about all of that again sometime, because as you said, that's a whole episode in and of itself of what is mom doing daily to resource herself.
Yes.
To be this person, because it's not discussed. It's like, I didn't have my children in a hospital, but I know people who did. You're just out there. You're like, okay, the baby's with you now.
Yeah.
So long. For everyone listening who's, okay, I need to speak with this woman one-on-one, where can they find you and connect with you?
I'd love to speak with people who feel called to chat. So my website is goodnightmoonchild.com. There are many ways to get in touch with me there. You can email me, Brittany, Brittany, at goodnightmoonchild.com, or come hang out on Instagram at goodnightmoonchild. I love to have conversations in my DMs and try to be very open on there.
Yeah, your Instagram is full of committed devotees, and for good reason. So, Britt, it has been so awesome to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Thanks, Corinne. This was really fun and so special. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and your medicine. I appreciate you.
I hope to do it again sometime. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Please reach out with any comments or with other guests you'd like to hear. You can find us at latebloomerranch.com or on Instagram at latebloomerranch. You can also drop me an email at hello@latebloomerranch.com. I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.